It's 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine, where in this next hour of programming, the opinions and views expressed are not necessarily those of KUCI, UCI, or the University of California Board of Regents, or a crying baby for that matter. It's Talking Animals now, KUCI.
Looks like morning's coming on. It seems we're at the edge of dawn. It's breaking with your morning log. I watch the stars as they turn to gray, and how soon it will turn to day. And I don't want to say goodbye.
Okay, that's music from Robinella and the CC String Band, a song called Morning Dove, as we ease into today's edition of Talking Animals on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine, and streaming live, of course, on the internet at KUCI.org. And the whole enterprise, the whole shebang, is broadcasting from the University of California at Irvine. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'll be with you till 10 o'clock this morning with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. Right off the bat, I'd like to tell you that for the next hour, you can reach us directly by phone at 949-824-5824, 949-UCI, KUCI, and I absolutely urge you to use that number. Call us at any point in the show. Don't be shy. I'm telling you, we love to get calls. Otherwise, we get a bit lonely here at the KUCI studios. And we're pretty darn friendly here at Talking Animals, especially so with other callers. We're not looking for a big tussle, confrontation. So call in. Say hello. Weigh in. It's all about animals. Whatever you got. We love to hear it. Other ways to be in touch include emailing us at talkinganimals@AOL.com and checking out our wonderful website at talkinganimals.net. That's right, Serena. Welcome back. That's .net, folks. Also, before we move on, I want to thank Serena Sharp for another stirring, rousing, superb session. I was trying to get more Sibyl and S's there, but I didn't pull it off. But anyways, I'm the Serena Sharp Show. Meanwhile, here at Talking Animals, okay, now, that brief bit of dead air was just putting a baby bottle back into a baby's mouth. All right, so that's what's going to be going on all show today. But that's fine, because we have one of our youngest co-hosts ever here, I think, today. A little over 4 months. So whatever he wants, that comes first. All right, but we'll still power through Talking Animals. And in fact, meanwhile, at Talking Animals, you're primarily strived to learn about animals and animal issues from our guests, from news items, from your calls, from assorted other sources, but we're also here each week to celebrate animals through music, comedy, and other means. It's been the better part of 9 months since we launched Talking Animals, and we've been enormously fortunate during that time to have a long string of really terrific guests, ranging from Dr. Sophia Yin, a veterinarian who's done pioneering research on dog barks and what they mean, to Dan Matthews, who is Vice President of Communication at PETA, is the chief strategist of the organization's high-profile campaigns, to our recent spirited, sprawling, truly stimulating conversation with comedian, actress, activist, and animal lover Janine Garofalo. And heck, last week our guest was Alan Young, who played Wilbur Post on Mr. Ed. That's right, folks. Not only are the shows featuring those interviews, at least most of them, archived on our nifty website at www.talkinganimals.net, but our string of exceptional guests continues today when we speak with Dr. Dee Boersma, a professor of biology at the University of Washington and an internationally renowned expert on penguins, who will talk with us about, you guessed it, penguins, including a penguin study she's been conducting for more than 20 years. We'll find out about that study and what she's found and a lot more about penguins in just a few minutes. Meanwhile, here on Talking Animals, it's time for our weekly look at items of interest in animal news. And I want to remind you of the phone number to join us on the show with your own comments and questions about animals. Not only this week's animal news items, but also any other topic you'd care to discuss, announcements, observations. There's an event you have coming up that we should know about, animal-related. Any stories you might have spotted that we might not have. They all would be most welcome. 949-824-5824. 949-UCI-KUCI. So turning now to interesting or important developments recently in animal news, typically these are local, regional, national, sometimes international animal stories of note that seem important to spotlight, and with any luck to get your comments on and discuss. We'll also try to include a few announcements of upcoming events or activities that you may want to pencil in on your calendar as soon as we adjust the baby bottle. That's one of the many virtues of having music underneath the blabber is when a guy goes to reposition a baby bottle, you still hear something, right? That's beautiful. So it's not really dead air in that one. Okay, so anyway. Okay, so one of the sort of things I think that we should top this week's animal news with is that the Los Angeles Animal Services chief quit. And among the reasons that's notable is, well, let me just read part of the LA Times coverage on it. We'll maybe go from there. The activist who had been protesting Los Angeles Animal Services General Manager Jerry Greenwald for 9 months got their wish Tuesday, this being last Tuesday. Greenwald is stepping down. Greenwald, 63, whose Santa Monica home had been vandalized and the word murderer spray painted on his car to protest what activists said were the unacceptable number of dogs and cats put to death in the city's animal shelters, will retire on April 12th, Mayor James K. Hahn announced. Quote, Jerry Greenwald has done an amazing job under extraordinarily difficult circumstances, Hahn said in a prepared statement, noting that animal adoptions had increased and that euthanasia had declined. I thank Jerry for his dedication and wish him the best in retirement. Animal activists who disputed claims that conditions in the animal shelters are improving called the move a victory. Since June, a core group of activists had waged a relentless, bitter campaign against Greenwald that had included not only demonstrations at his house, but visits to City Hall, local animal shelters, and Hahn's home in San Pedro, with activists carrying pictures of dead dogs. Quote, we'd like to think that we have something to do with Mr. Greenwald's retirement, said Jerry Vlasic, co-founder of the Los Angeles chapter of the Animal Defense League. So, anyways, any thoughts or comments on that? That has been a gigantically emotionally charged issue for, 7, 8, 9 months at least. And, if you have any thoughts on the techniques employed or the results or maybe what will happen post-Greenwalt, 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. Want to touch on something else that's really important, especially if you're down anywhere near the San Diego area. Another slight adjustment on the baby bottle. And that is the Feral Cat Fixathon coming up on March 14th. And the Feral Cat Coalition, Spay Neuter Action Project, and Rancho San Diego Animal Hospital are joining together to establish a world record for the number of feral cats spayed or neutered, meaning fixed. Hold on one second. All right. What is a feral cat? Feral cats are homeless, the wild offspring of abandoned, unaltered domestic cats. All right, well, there's a few different ways to do this. Okay, so you can be part of the solution. If someone you know is caring for stray, unowned cats, let them know about this important event. Make a reservation, phone area code 619-497-1599. Then bring stray cats, please, unowned cats only. It's really important. To the Feral Cat Fixathon. This is a free clinic. It's March 14th, 2004. Obviously, this is March coming up. That'd be 6 days? This Saturday, yeah, sorry. And starting at 8:30 a.m. at Rancho San Diego Animal Hospital, El Cajon. So, again, this is just one of many ways to deal with just the incredible, you know, cat population, and especially with feral and stray cats to, you know, develop colonies, or just generally, obviously, they're not fixed. They multiply like crazy, and then many of them can't eat or really have any kind of life to speak of. So this is really, really important. Any kind of spay-neuter program, of course, is extremely important, as we always emphasize here on Talking Animals. But this is a great opportunity for a bunch of feral cats to get fixed for free. So anyways, you can contact San Diego Animal Hospital in El Cajon at area code 619-497-1599 for more info on that. Also, less close to home, but certainly very important, from the Associated Press, this other piece, Dateline Seattle. Can I say Dateline Seattle? I think I can. The Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife proposed Monday that Puget Sound's orcas be added to the state list of endangered species because the marine mammals are at critically low levels and are vulnerable to several continuing threats. The department made the recommendation based on a recent status report indicating that the population of resident killer whales in Puget Sound and nearby waters has declined 18% since 1995. Quote, the solid scientific work reflected in this report gives us an excellent base on which to assess the health of our resident orca population and determine what the next step should be to protect one of the most enduring symbols of Puget Sound and the Pacific Northwest, said Jeff Konings, the department's director. The killer whales that swim in the waters off Washington State and British Columbia include 84 orcas, down from a historical high of more than 120 in the 1960s, before the whales were captured in large numbers for display at marine parks. The L-pod, one of three groups of resident whales, has seen both higher mortality rates and lower birth rates, particularly in the last decade, according to the department's status report. Scientists point to a decline in salmon, the orca's main source of food, as well as accumulations of PCBs and other toxic chemicals in the water and stress from whale-watching boats and other vessels that obviously circle around these orcas constantly. So, anyways, any thoughts on that? 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. We're going to pause here. We're not really pause. We're just going to take a little detour as we do, mid-news segment, for a quick instant true-false quiz. It's an animal quiz, of course. It's true-false. One question, and the first person to call in with the correct answer wins a prize. And again, these aren't just crummy old prizes. They're, we got everything from CDs and books that tied to guests that we've had here on Talking Animals. We've got all kinds of apparel, t-shirts, sweatshirts, other kinds of animal, you know, from animal organizations. We've got a really cool umbrella that we just got in. We got a nice windbreaker parka thing. We got jewelry, we got animal accessories, leashes, collars, etc. So, you know, we got some good prizes here. So, having said that, here's our question. It's true, false. First person to call in with the correct answer will win their choice of one of those prizes. Here it is. The smallest monkey, the pygmy marmoset, is the size of an adult human's index finger. True, false. 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. The smallest monkey, the pygmy marmoset, is the size of an adult human's index finger. So, if you know that and you're the first one to call in with the correct answer, well then, you get one of those cool prizes. See how that works? That's pretty good, right? That's right. Okay, so we will continue now with our animal news. And this is a really another highly disturbing story. It's various publications are covering. I've got this sent to me and Associated Press are covering it, LA Times, whatever. But anyways, the upshot is still the same, which is basically from Wyoming. Wildlife officials are combing the snow-covered high plains here for clues to explain the mysterious death of 280 elk, more than 60% of a herd that inhabits the southern edge of Wyoming's Red Desert. State game and fish officials say they cannot recall an elk die-off of this magnitude unrelated to harsh winter weather. The stricken elk, wintering in a broad swale, were found beginning a few weeks ago, dying of dehydration or starvation. There are a lot of strange things about this, said Dr. David Barber, Hey, you know what? Maybe somebody's, looks like somebody might be calling in. All right, I'm going to move all my stuff, see if we can answer this. Hold on. And is Talking Animals, you're on the air?
Yes.
Hi, do you have a guess on the quiz question?
I think it's false.
I'm sorry?
False.
Oh, shoot. Well, you had a 50% chance, and unfortunately, it's actually true.
It's true?
Yeah.
Wow.
I know, that's why it was kind of a cool question, I thought, because it's hard to imagine a monkey being the size of an index finger, but indeed, in the case of the pygmy marmoset, that's what size they are. So, but better luck next time, and actually, if you email me at talkinganimals@AOL.com, just for listening and calling in, which we always want to encourage, we will set you up with some kind of cool prize. So email me, give me your contact, you know, where I could send you something, and we'll get you something cool because we love to encourage our Talking Animals listeners. So,
okay,
what's your name, by the way?
Steven.
Yeah. And what kind of animal, if any, do you have living with you?
I have a dog, actually.
Oh, yeah? What's the dog's name?
It's a little chihuahua named Pepe.
Name what, sorry?
Pepe. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, so maybe, when you email me, we'll find something cool for Pepe or just for you from our big bag of cool prizes. But I appreciate you calling in. And next time, I'm sure you'll get the right answer.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Cool, man. Thanks. Bye. All right, sir. All right. So. All right, well, you know, he's right. He should be having this bottle directly placed, and nobody should be vibing on the radio and whatever. So, anyways, just going to finish up a little bit on this elk's story. And it's Katie Shy, Talking Animals. You're on the air live.
Yes, hi, it's Liz. I'd like to answer that question.
All right, but since we just had someone call in and it's only true-false and they guessed wrong, I don't know if it'd be fair, really.
Okay, we'll just let it go for now. I can hear the co-host in the background.
Yes, he's one of our most precocious broadcasters here at KUCI. So.
That is amazing. Okay,
yeah.
I'm enjoying the show.
Okay, well, thanks
bye
for calling.
Now.
Bye-bye. All right, so back to the elk story, because this really is kind of both puzzling and you know, really unfortunate in a lot of ways. So anyways, the guy from the Wyoming Health Department goes on to say, it is an unusual clinical presentation. The legs seem to be especially weak, or there is neurological paralysis. Yeah, in the early stages, the head and neck and eye movement are perfectly intact. Everything about it is unprecedented. The number dying, the number affected, all in a fairly small area. Now, one thing cool about a co-host is he does make dolphin noises, which I think is entirely appropriate for talking animals. Okay, more dolphin boy, less... So, Steve veterinarians say that they have found nothing in the annals of wildlife medicine that mimics the symptoms displayed by the normally robust elk here. In addition to the unexplained paralysis or general weakness, forensic experts find it odd that the illness has targeted females, which make up nearly 84% of the affected animals. Strange, too, is the capricious nature of the outbreak. Nearby herds of antelope, mule deer, and wayward livestock have not been affected, nor, officials say, do the affected elk appear to be contagious.
What do you think of that, Mike? Pleasant, isn't it?
So, anyway, very odd and disturbing story. Again, any thoughts or comments on that or any other items in our Talking Animal News? 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. Back much more locally for an announcement. You might recall, if you're a long-time listener at least, back in August, one of our guests was Tawny Lee Thompson, a vet tech down in Saddleback, who teaches periodic classes on first aid and CPR for pets, for cats and dogs. That's right. It was a very cool segment. And a new group of classes have come up. Some of them have come and gone. I've announced them all on the air. And there's still one more still pending. And it's a five-hour course, just one day. It's Sundays from noon to 5. And the course teaches individuals to recognize and respond to pet emergencies. The class will cover how to approach and handle injured pets, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, controlling bleeding, and treatment of shock, as well as how to manage more common emergencies like choking, snake bites, fractured limbs, and poisoning. So when you take the course, you'll get, of course, that knowledge. You'll get a cool book. You'll get certified, because this is an American Red Cross sanctioned class. You'll get a Red Cross certificate of completion. So, again, that's one more of these coming up, and there'll be another round, you know, down the road. There was a couple that we talked about in February, and then there's one this month still pending on March 21st in Huntington Beach. So to find out more about that or to sign up for it, you can call Trina at 949-586-4250. That's Trina at 949-586-4250 to find out more or indeed sign up for pet first aid and CPR for cats and dogs. So, you know what? I think that might just about do it for today's. Today's edition of Animal News. And, of course, if there are ever any news stories or announcements or events you'd like to bring to our attention, please feel free to email us those items at talkinganimals@aol.com. And if they're really pending or pressing, you can, by all means, call us, you know, while we're on the air, 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. I would also love to encourage you to email us with comments about the show, suggestions of future guests, ideas about animal songs, animal comedy bits, any other animal topic that's on your mind. That email, again, is talkinganimals@aol.com. And I'm pleased to remind you, perhaps redundantly so, about the Talking Animals website. We hope you'll check out the site at www.talkinganimals.net. That's right, that's .net. And join the email list. Just sign up for that list, and then we'll keep you posted on upcoming guests and other cool announcements. You'll also find archives and synopses of the shows, assorted photographs and articles, all kinds of links, other audio pieces, and more. And so just please stop by and take a look around the site. Again, it's talkinganimals.net. It's time now to step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which, as always, of course, involves an animal-oriented piece of comedy. This is Bill Engvall with a piece called Discovery Channel on today's Comedy Corner here on KUCI.
I try to watch good TV with my kids. That's hard. There's not a lot good on TV anymore. But I'll tell you what we do watch and we enjoy the heck out of it. It's that Discovery Channel, those animal shows. Oh, I love those things. Yes. They had one on called Animals of the Sahara Desert. This was a classic. Because there's this desert wasp that spends his whole life digging a hole in the sand for his mate, all right? And she just stands there, griping at him. He's digging for all he's worth, man. And she's like, I want a pool. And And he dies digging this hole. And you'd think after an hour of digging, he'd be like, you know, you're getting uglier by the minute. I can tell you that right now. They said in this special that the sands of the Sahara Desert get to be like 150 degrees on the surface. And there's this lizard that when his feet get too hot, he won't move, but he just stands there and goes. It's like if he could talk, he'd be going, whoo! Man, this sand is hot. And your wife's just thinking, well, find some shade, loser. And there's these bugs, their whole job is just to run. They just get in a straight line and book it across the desert. Nowhere to go. Just like one of them gets up in the morning and says, y'all ready to run? The rest of them go, hit it, buddy. We're right behind you. Let's run by that lizard. He's hysterical. And they just take off. And there's this snake that eats these bugs. But he can't lay on top of the sand because they'll see him. So he crawls underneath the sand and listens for these bugs to come running by. If you can hear bugs running on sand, what do you need to hide for? You're way ahead of them. They even know where they're going. You see that snake in the sand with his buddies like, shh, shh, shh. Here they come. Yeah, that's him, that's him, that's him. Hear that one? He's got a limp. Hear it? How do animals know which the weakest one? It's like lions and zebras. They don't hang out together. But the lions always seem to know which the weakest zebra. And all I figured, there must be like a squealer zebra. You know, one little wussy zebra doesn't want to get eaten, so he narks on all his buddies. You know, he goes sneaking up to the lions and like, hey, fellas, fellas. All right, here's the deal. There's a herd of us a couple hundred yards down there. Now, everybody's in pretty good shape. Except Bob. He's a smoker. Now I'll tell you what animal got the raw end of the deal in life. That's the frog. Because think about it. If we eat something and it's bad, what do? We just spit it out. We're like, ooh, ugh. But frogs got that sticky tongue. So if they zap like a really nasty fly, you know, it's like, ow, man! I can do it myself!
All right, that was Bill Engvall with a piece called Discovery Channel, taken from his CD entitled Dirtfish. The Comedy Corner is, of course, one of the signature features of Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and you're indeed listening to Talking Animals on KECI 88.9 FM broadcasting from the University of California at Irvine. As many of you know, we're also streaming live on the internet at www.kuci.org. Some of you, in fact, no doubt, are listening that very way, and some of you perhaps got there through our website at talkinganimals.net. Before we proceed, I'm obliged to remind you that the opinions and views expressed on Talking Animals are not necessarily those of KUCI, UC Irvine, or the University of California Board of Regents. Earlier in the show, I mentioned that this week's guest is Dr. Dee Boersma, professor of biology at the University of Washington and an internationally renowned expert on penguins. Hell, if there's anyone on the planet who knows more about penguins, they probably are a penguin. So let's get our conversation, let's get right to our conversation with her. In an interview recorded a few days ago, this is Dr. Dee Boersma on Talking Animals here at KUCI. Joining us today on Talking Animals is Dr. Dee Boersma. Welcome, Dr. Boersma.
Well, thank you very much, Doug.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. And as I've mentioned, or will mention by the time this airs, to our listeners, you're clearly one of the most renowned experts on penguins anywhere, and you've been conducting a study on penguins for 20 years, and I want to definitely get into that and talk penguins, penguins, penguins. But in speaking with someone who's so passionately committed to animals and so accomplished, I always think it's kind of useful and interesting to find out a bit of history and sort of get context. So maybe if we could just back up a ways and start off, did you grow up with animals? Was your family animal-oriented? Were you always an animal person?
Actually, I guess I started out more as an insect person, and those count as animals, but I started out as a kind of a butterfly collector and a bird watcher.
Really? As a kid, you mean?
Yeah, as a kid.
Wow.
And was my mother bought me a butterfly net, and killing jar and said, you know, every kid should have a hobby, and so here's a hobby. And being a good Midwesterner, felt like I should at least try it, and I ended up really loving being able to identify different sorts of insects, and particularly butterflies.
Wow, and so what age was this, and for how long did you continue?
Oh, I started at about 9, and I was an avid, you know, really lepidopterist until probably high school, when then it was not quite so cool.
but did that kind of evolve into other animals at that point, or just that you kind of like set the butterfly collecting on the back burner?
Well, I kind of set the butterfly collecting on the back burner, but I guess what it led to is just a really deep appreciation for habitat and mm-hmm. for the natural world. And
I see.
From turtles to butterflies, so I became really very much interested in the natural environment.
So this is really a kind of a long arc, really, from childhood, really, to what you're doing as we speak, it sounds like.
Yes, I mean, we didn't have the Discovery Channel growing up, but it turns out I love living in the Discovery Channel.
I see.
That's what I find you know, really interesting and where my passion lies.
Sure. And was there a specific event as you were making your way through high school and beyond that you know, said, hey, you know what, I really, really want to do this. I want to pursue this, you know, professionally, academically, et cetera.
I guess the only thing was seeing butterflies go away and moths. So as I grew up, it used to be there were butterflies all over the place, and mm-hmm. moths, too. I mean, big silk moths, Luna moths,
sure.
Cecropias, things like that. And suddenly, we didn't find them anymore. And it wasn't really until college that I realized it was because of pesticides, particularly the heavy use of DDT.
Yeah.
My mother, you know, thought that the demise of butterflies and moths was largely my fault. But it
you single-handedly did this.
Right.
Yeah.
But it became really clear to me that this was a major change in the environment. And then places that I used to go and hunt turtles and watch them, suddenly they were developed, and there were houses all the way along the outside of these lakes, and there were no turtles to speak of.
Mm.
So it was those sorts of events, I think, in high school that catalyzed me to feel that there must be a better way to live in balance with nature.
Yeah.
And I just became committed to not only spending time in those sorts of places, but seeing if there wasn't something that I could do to help balance what seemed to me a world that was getting horribly out of balance. And since I've gotten older, I think is even more out of balance than when I was younger.
Sure. Well, so it sounds like these kind of little epiphanies, as you describe them, kind of set you on that general path. But then how did that lead you into the world of penguins, which, of course, we definitely want to focus on it for today?
Well, I mean, again, in a quick nutshell, I went to graduate school because I really wanted to work in the Galapagos Islands.
Okay.
I mean, I knew about the Galapagos Islands because of Charles Darwin. I always wanted to go there, and I picked a university where I could work in the Galapagos. So that started me on it, and once I realized I was going to get a chance to work in the Galapagos, I found that there was a penguin that was there and nobody knew anything about it, that the only two nests had ever been found in all of you know, the history of the Galapagos. And so I thought, well, you can't go wrong if you study something that nobody knows anything about. You've got to learn something.
You're definitely trailblazing, no matter how you slice it. Yeah. So
and,
what kind of penguin was that?
Galapagos penguin.
Okay.
And so I fell in love with penguins, and mm-hmm. I've been interested in them ever since.
Wow. And what school is this? Because you mentioned that school played a role in getting
Ohio State University is where I got my PhD.
I see. And so then how did this kind of unfold towards launching the penguin study?
Well, I continued to work on seabirds, spent mm-hmm. some time working in Alaska on particularly forktail storm petrels, and realized I really missed penguins. And out of all the species of penguins, one of the most poorly known at that point, since I'd learned a lot about the Galapagos penguin, was the Magellanic penguin. And here
mm-hmm.
it is, a temperate species of penguin living around people, and we know almost nothing about it. And so I wrote a grant, and then at that time when I wrote this grant, the Japanese came in, a Japanese company, the Hyundai company, and said that they would like to start harvesting Magellanic penguins, and they were going to turn them into high-fashion gloves and protein and oil. And so the Wildlife Conservation Society hooked up with the Office of Tourism in the province of Chubut, and that started our long-term research on Magellanic penguins at Punta Tombo.
Wow. And I guess I just have to respond to the word harvest when people are talking about doing what they had in mind to do with those penguins. But anyways, welcome to, I guess, that world. But so with that in mind, then, kind of what are the sort of chief objectives, I mean, relative to Hundi, I guess, coming in and others, I mean, what has been the...
Well, the first objective was to try to find out how many penguins there were and if there was going to be some killing of harvesting of penguins to be able to at least do it in a somewhat intelligent way.
Sure.
But, of course, it didn't take any rocket scientists to know that if they wanted to harvest something like 48,000 penguins a year and then increase it presumably from there, that would decimate the population in short order.
Sure.
And I think the exciting thing about the research is that now there's over 50,000 people that visit Punta Tombo every year for tourists, ecotourism and such. And there's no discussion, of course, of any killing or harvesting of penguins now.
Yeah.
And so we've come at least past that sort of danger. But that's been a common sort of parameter for all people. I mean, you know, where is our buffalo? Whenever you see huge concentrations, somebody thinks they can make a buck and they want to try.
Sure.
So I think the exciting thing for me is now people are not thinking about that, but the real problem for penguins is that they face a number of threats, and particularly temperate species of penguins, because they live in environments that they have to share with humans.
Yeah.
Of course, not only the fishing that we're doing in the ocean is just incredible, the number of things that are taken out, and it's so disgusting what comes out, you know, with it. I always think that if people, when they order a shrimp cocktail, if the 20 pounds of bycatch could be dumped on their head, you know, when they order the cocktail, they get a sense of what are they really eating.
Right. It's sort of that the, I mean, if we're going to use the term harvest for kill, I guess we can use collateral damage, because it seems like, you know, people don't really imagine what else is being affected. And obviously penguins are, you know, what, caught in nets and other things that happen as a byproduct of that kind of fishing effort, right? Not to mention their food sources.
Exactly.
Yeah. Geez. And what are some other findings of the study, I mean, that have kind of, you know, the broadest implications for this kind of thing, the ocean, conservation?
Well, I think of penguins as little sentinels of the environment. I mean, they can tell us a lot about what's happening, not only on land, but also in the water. So one of their major problems, at least along the coast of Argentina for years, it was the dumping of oily ballast water that was literally oiling about 21,000 juveniles every year and about 20,000 adults.
Wow.
And that was just because it's a lot cheaper to dump ballast water than to process it and dump
properly,
it correctly on,
right,
on land. But this last March, we did our normal survey, and in some years we were finding 60 to 80% of the dead penguins along the shore covered in oil, and last March, none of them were. So it's just been really gratifying. The tanker lanes were moved an extra 100 kilometers offshore, but really what's happened is people are not dumping ballast water anymore.
Yeah. And again, so it's just a product of educating them and just broader awareness that sort of forces people's hand in that way.
Right, and making it politically costly.
Right,
absolutely. Do the wrong thing.
Sure.
We want to help people do the right thing. I mean, you and I would like to do the right thing most of the time, but
right,
a lot of times we don't know what that is.
Sure.
Or the economic incentives are wrong. I mean, here we are subsidizing fuel so people can travel all over the ocean to fish all the fish out. We should be paying the real environmental cost for many of these things, and if we did, then, you know, you and I intelligently could decide, yeah, we want to do this, but we'd pay the real environmental cost.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, mostly wildlife ends up paying a lot of the cost.
Well, and it's just like the example you gave a moment ago about the shrimp cocktail. I mean, until you force someone to really think about something or present specific tangible evidence of what the costs are, they just sort of blithely go on doing what they're doing.
Yeah, because, like, one of my real fears now is people are moving more and more to farm-raised, like, salmon, and they think that that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But the question is, what do the farm-raised salmon eat?
Mm-hmm.
And they eat other salmon. So we harvest all these chum salmon, turn them into pellets, and then we feed those to these fish in pens, or we feed them, in the case of Chile, most of the small sardines and anchovies from the Humboldt Current area. Well, when we fed all those, where is it going to come next?
Mm-hmm.
And the seabirds along the Peruvian coast, there used to be, we estimate, something like 100 million birds, and now we're talking about maybe 4 million birds.
Wow.
So, you know, it's gone down just orders of magnitude.
Yeah.
And it's these spectacles of nature that in part, I think, certainly invigorate the human spirit. And I guess I hope that the world of the future still has room for these wildlife spectacles.
Sure.
You know, as well as some people, and, of course, consumption of some of these resources as well, but certainly not the way we're doing it now.
And I think as part of that, I mean, people may not know, or just the average person may not know as much about penguins. I mean, you know, I think there's sort of the stereotypical information and the cliched information, I guess, about penguins, but you really have to be exposed to just some of the things you've described to sort of understand what kind of threats they do face.
And this global climate change is mm-hmm. really a major problem,
yeah.
of course, for many species, but penguins are one, because in the Antarctic, you can actually see the effects of global climate change already in the Antarctic Peninsula. I mean, we know about the breaking up of the ice sheets, and we hear that, and of course, the Antarctic Peninsula is warming really quickly, but the big part of the Antarctic, the East Antarctic, it doesn't look like there's nearly as much change there. Mm-hmm. But on the Antarctic Peninsula, you can see the effect on penguins, because the warming has led to increased snowfall. I mean, that's counterintuitive in a way,
mm-hmm.
but when you get warmer environment, the air can hold more moisture, and so it ends up coming out as wet snow and rain. And it used to be much drier on that Antarctic Peninsula and colder, and those penguins don't do well when there's several meters of snow on their nesting site.
Oh, my goodness.
So this year we went to three times one island, and the penguins were delayed by at least 2 or 3 weeks because they couldn't even see any rocks, and you can't lay an egg on snow. You got to get to the rock, because these guys sit on top of their eggs. They don't put it on their feet like the emperor penguins or the king penguins. So they have to lay it on something that they can warm up.
And is there a specific window, too, so that if they are delayed in the manner you described, that has those kind of implications as well?
Yeah, because, of course, when you go down to the southern hemisphere, in the wintertime, it gets, if you go far enough south, it's dark.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So what's happening for these guys is the lights are getting lower and lower, and so their window of opportunity to fish every day is getting shorter and shorter. So they've got to move north. So we think of all of our birds going south, or at least a lot of them going south in the winter. What happens in the Antarctic is a lot of the birds move north for the winter.
Yeah. Wow. So it really is starting already have some serious recognizable consequences.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And we've already learned, if we didn't already know through the course of this conversation, that penguins are not, as maybe the stereotype would suggest, only found in cold regions. What are, just to hit a couple other quick things, I mean, are they only, and by the way, I'm getting some of this, people should know that if they want to find out more from Dr. Boersma than we're maybe able to cover in this interview, a simple search turns up a really cool site where you have all kinds of questions and then like real audio and video answers. I mean, of course, you're making people like me obsolete, but but nonetheless, it's really, really cool. But just to hit a few of those. So again, people think of penguins as black and white and just that, but that's not necessarily their only coloring.
No, penguins really are pretty much black and white, but mm-hmm. they do have some interesting head, I guess, ornaments or dressing. So mm-hmm. some of them have yellow plumes like rockhopper penguins, and some of them have white throats like royal penguins, and
yeah.
some have some orange and yellow like macaroni penguins. But there are actually 17 species of penguins, and they're all, of course, only found in the southern hemisphere. The only one that barely gets into the northern hemisphere is the Galapagos penguin.
Mm-hmm.
But the equator is a pretty good boundary line.
Sure.
Of course, people did try to move penguins from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere, so there were some experiments where people picked up a whole bunch of penguins and took them to Norway and dumped them in the fjords, and they lived there for a while, but never really took off. And
oh, yeah.
And probably in part because the northern climes have a lot more predators. So you've got bears and foxes that can get around, and they're not really safe. And, of course, in Antarctica, there are no bears.
Right, right.
So the predators are basically pretty much absent.
I see. And just to hit a couple other things that people think they know or do know about penguins, I mean, are they indeed as monogamous as the reputation there?
Depends on the species, but for these Magellanic penguins that I've worked on, we have one pair that's been together for 17 years. That's a long time.
That is a long time. And how do you measure that, by the way?
Well, we go and we're like the census department. So every year, I mean, this is the longest term study that's been done, I guess, on really any species of penguin without any, government, direct line in the budget or something like that. Because there are some studies that have gone a long time in the Antarctic, but there's actually, funding base for that. But so we really depend in terms of our long-term funding on the Wildlife Conservation Society and lots of people that are interested in penguins and want to see us learn more about them and be able to live in better harmony with them. So we've gotten a lot of support just from individuals that have donated to the University of Washington. But in terms of these penguins and really trying to think about what do they need in the long term, we don't know that much. And so that's why it's been important to use things like satellite telemetry, which we're doing now to see where they forage, as well as studying them on land. And, of course, in many cases, they've been threatened because of introduced predators, like rats that have come to remote seabird islands that came actually with pirates and whalers, to things like New Zealand where there are penguins, but they've introduced things like weasels, stoats, that actually feed on penguin chicks and eggs.
Wow. And you know, your reference about what they do on land reminds me of when I was sort of preparing for this interview. At one point, in fact, in one of those kind of cool prepared responses that you have on that part of your website, it talks about when they're on land, they're fasting. But what I was really interested by is why do they fast and how common is that and what prompts that?
Well, you can think of penguins as kind of on the yo-yo diet cycle.
Okay.
They go out and they feed at sea because all of course that they eat is in the ocean. So most penguins eat fish and squid, crustaceans, things like that. And none of that's on land. So when they're in the sea, they can forage a lot. And when they're on land, there's nothing to eat.
Okay.
So they have to be able to fast. And so they sometimes will fast for over a month.
Wow. And they're just equipped, obviously, to do that, and that's without any particular hardship, I guess, to them.
Yeah. Occasionally it's fairly stressful because they may not have gained enough to be able to go through, the long fast.
Yeah.
But most of the time, they're pretty good at it, and so it's like you and I going through Thanksgiving and Christmas. And the New Year's resolution is always to lose weight.
Sure.
The difference is for penguins, it's enforced because they're standing around on land and losing all their feathers and then growing new ones.
Yeah, no, they're pretty committed at that point.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess another thing that's interesting about the penguins, and I sort of asked this too as a new father, I guess I'm really interested in what makes for good penguin parenting, like good dads, I notice.
Well, one of the exciting things about penguins is not only are they, many of them, faithful and monogamous, but fidelity, of course, is a different sort of thing than just monogamy.
Right.
But they are very egalitarian. So both the males and the females sit on the eggs, and both the males and females defend the nest against other intruders, and both of them feed the young. So they're always taking turns.
Yeah, that's shared parenting and then some, I guess. Yeah,
it is.
And how do mom and dad penguin find junior penguin, baby penguin, whatever, in a colony of, hundreds, maybe thousands of seemingly very similar-looking penguin offspring?
Right. Well, first of all, once you start looking at penguins, they don't all look the same. So you can actually tell them apart.
Yeah.
But, it's kind of like the first time, I guess, you see people, they might all look the same. But once you really get to know your family, they look different from the neighbors.
I see.
So penguins also learn, individuals because they're long-lived, and so they learn them by how they look, but mostly they learn them by their voices. So for penguins coming home to find their offspring, the first place they go is you know, their nest.
Mm-hmm.
And so they know where their home is, and they know that home address, and they get there and look there. But then they call. And so if Junior is out next door or hanging out someplace else with a bunch of other chicks, they hear mom or dad call, mm-hmm. and so they come running because that's the dinner bell.
And is it in the same way that you said that, you know, people, you know, might look all the same until you really realize they look differently? Does a penguin, baby penguin or a young penguin's call, I mean, its parents' call to them, is that as recognizable as when my mom used to call me to come in for dinner when I was out playing? I mean, is it, you know, or does it, are there really different sounds? And what does a penguin call sound like, by the way?
Well, let me answer that in two ways. First of all, when the chicks are little, it's mm-hmm. just like with your being a dad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, either you or your wife is with the child at all, almost all the time.
Right.
Or you know where you've put the child, and so you can come back.
Right,
you know,
sure.
You know, yeah. Right where it is. Well, that's true for penguins, too. Until the chick is really about 30 days old, sometimes even 40 or 50, they're not demanding that much food. So one of the adults always is guarding that young chick so that nobody can come and eat it.
Yeah,
so that, you know, a skua, which is a like a gull-like bird, but they eat a lot of penguin chicks, they try to get it if the chick was little. And so this way, the adult is there to guard it and to sit on it and protect it from the environment, whether it's rain or snow or predators that come in.
I see. Wow, that's really...
And so they don't have to know the call until, you know, they're
later
30,
on.
Yeah, 30, 35 days old.
Cool. Well, Dr. Borsman, we're just sort of reaching the end of our time, but just let me hit you with a few odds and ends, because, I mean, I just find this all so fascinating. I'm sure our listeners feel the same way. What's, in all your years of being steeped in the penguin world, what's kind of the most weird or bizarre penguin behavior you might have witnessed?
Well, I guess I'll turn it around and say the most exciting thing to me about working on penguins all these years is that there's so many things that are not that different about penguins
mm-hmm.
than humans.
Mm.
I mean, so, you know, they're trying to make a living, and they're trying to go and raise their offspring,
sure.
and they're finding it really difficult in a number of different ways,
mm-hmm.
whether sometimes it's not enough food because all the fish have been taken out of the area, or
sure.
oil that's gotten dumped, or habitat development. But there's all kinds of factors that can affect their life, too. And so I guess I see the similarities as more interesting than the differences.
I see. And do you have, at this point, a favorite penguin that's emerged of the study?
Oh, heck, there's so many of them. Because now I banded a lot of birds that were breeding in 1982, and it's so exciting to go back and see them
mm-hmm.
and know that they're still alive.
Sure.
And the amazing thing is they appear to be ageless. The guys that are still alive... You know, I can't tell the difference in terms of how they walk or what they do from three-year-old penguins.
Really?
If I could just figure out how to market that, I wouldn't have to worry about funding anymore for penguins.
No, we'd be all set then. And do you name these penguins?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And how so? I mean, how do you arrive at a certain name for just the...
Well, frankly, if people donate to the Magellanic Penguin Project at the University of Washington and send us $5,000, they can name a penguin whatever they want, and we send them a map and follow the bird when it goes to sea on these foraging expeditions, because we're trying to figure out where are the important areas in the South Atlantic that these penguins really use,
sure.
because those are the areas that we need to worry about in terms of zoning and ocean uses.
And before we move on from there, is there a website specific location where people could go and find out more, and if they indeed wanted to either name a penguin or donate in any way?
Penguinstudies.com.
Okay, that's simple enough.
Or not com, I'm sorry, org.
Okay.
Yeah, penguinstudies.org.
Cool. And how often, I mean, you've made a couple of references to this, and I do think it's really interesting. How often does one encounter a study like yours that's really extended over 20 years' time?
Almost never.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what is so unusual about it. And so to finish about naming birds, we have birds named Dan, Thorn.
Okay.
We have Cheryl. We've got Peach, 1 and 2. We have Harry.
Wow.
So we've got a lot of different birds, and this year we sent out Packy.
Ah, cool. And how many of those were just names you and your, you know, sort of colleagues came up with, and how many of those are from people who've said, hey, you know what, I want to name a penguin?
All of those, including Tweety and PSB have all been named by people that have donated and helped support the Penguin Project.
Oh, that's so neat.
Because they're not only supporting the research, but also the training of conservation biologists.
Yeah, which is great to send that many more folks out in all directions doing that kind of work. And what are, I mean, some of this is, I guess, self-evident, but what are the chief virtues of a study like yours that has spanned so much time?
Well, we can start to ask questions about long-term climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So we can get some sort of sense of what's natural variation and what is really a long-term significant pattern. So, for example, we know that at Punta Tombo, where we've been working, we can quantify now from 1987 until this year that the population has declined by about 20%.
Mm.
So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that, you know, if those trends continue, we're going to be in trouble.
Yeah.
The exciting thing for us is that there's still a lot of penguins, and so we're starting to get a better handle on what it is that makes such a big difference. And we hope that the trend is going to be actually reversed in the next couple of years, because we've now seen a lot of birds that have come back in and to the population. They're standing on the beach. They're too young to breed because they don't breed until they're 4, 5, even 6, 7 years old.
Hmm.
But they're standing around, so they're getting ready.
Yeah.
And that means that they've survived. And so we hope that those are going to be coming back in shortly, and so we should see at least the population stabilize.
Oh,
and the major
great.
Reason, it seems, is in the last couple of years they closed the fishing industry when chicks were just about ready to fledge.
Mm.
And so it may be that there's more food that's available, but also reducing some of the conflicts with fisheries might be really important.
Wow, this is really, really interesting. Well, we are at the end of our time, Dr. Borsman, but just to wrap things up, if there were one fact or detail about penguins that most people don't know that you think they should, is there such a thing? Could you reduce something down to just, you know, one little tidbit that we all should be aware of that we aren't?
Yeah, that penguins are not that different from people, and they have to go through the same hardworking life that almost any of us do to survive.
Cool. I like that. Yeah, that's sort of become a little thread through our interview, so that's a great place to end it. So, Dr. Dee Borsma, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals, and good luck with your continued study, and hopefully some of our listeners, including myself, will get out and check out this these little penguin friends.
Well, thanks very much, Duncan.
Okay, take care now.
Bye-bye. All right, bye.
Okay, we want to thank again Dr. Dee Borsma for joining us today on Talking Animals. Again, I'm on the website. You may want to visit to find out more about her world of penguins, and specifically the really long-term cool study she has done and talked about there. It's www.penguinstudies.org. I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals on KUCI and Irvine 88.9 FM, streaming live on the internet at KUCI.org. It's time now to proceed to name that animal tune. Remarkably like any other version, I'll name that tune you care to mention, except that in this game, the tunes are always animal-related. Isn't that right, Mike? Usually just by virtue of one of our animals being part of the song title, but occasionally it's a bit more indirect than that. Either way, like most renditions of the game, we can only provide a brief snippet of the tune in question for a number of reasons, not least that while, of course, the game hinges on a song being somewhat recognizable, we also don't want to stray too far for too long from the KUCI music policy. So, with that preamble behind us, and also knowing there's always a prize, yes, one of our very cool prizes, for the very first caller who calls correctly identifies, I guess is what I'm trying to say, the song and artist. So as soon as you recognize this animal tone, please phone us at 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. Okay, let's get started. It's Talking Animals on KUCI. Anyone? Can anyone name that animal tune? All right, well, you can always call in, but we're sort of really at the end of our time here on this week's edition of Talking Animals. So I want to remind you that the views and opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of KUCI, UCI, or the University of California Board of Regents. I want to thank again our guest, Dr. Dee Borsma, and you can visit, again, that website is www.penguinstudies.org. I also want to thank you all for listening. Hope you'll join us next Monday on Talking Animals, when our guest will be Francis Batista from the L.A. wing, as it were, of Best Friends Animal Society. We'll fill us in on such forthcoming events as the Super Adoption and the Lint Roller and some of the other cool things that they do just day-to-day, week-to-week on the local Best Friends. So please join us for that next Monday. March 15th on Talking Animals. Again, I want to urge you to check out our website, talkinganimals.net, and when you get there, please sign up for our email list. We can alert you to guest bookings and other events and announcements. I also encourage you to email us with comments, guest suggestions, ideas about show topics, songs, comedy bits, news stories, and anything else that you'd like to pass along. It's at talkinganimals@AOL.com. I really look forward to hearing from you. Please stay tuned for Jeff Scott and the Blues Disease, his great, great blues show here on KUCI. And maybe let's take a quick random crazy shot. KUCI, you're on the air live Talking Animals. Are you there? No? All right. Anyway, as always, we're going to close things out with a... an animal-related tune. This is Badly Drawn Boy with Have You Fed the Fish? Again, we urge you to catch the Blues Disease, which will be infecting you momentarily. This is 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. And we'll catch you next week on Talking Animals.
Sometimes you've got to